Day. Happy Martin Luther King Day, if it's Martin Luther King Day in your country. Just to begin our time together, we'll start by closing the eyes. And just begin to settle down. So softening the shoulders and the tailbone and the feet. Seeing if we can keep the crown lifted towards the ceiling and the back straight, the heart open. And then moving our awareness to the breath, moving in and out of the nostrils. And if we notice the mind is chattering, just allowing that, but then drawing that awareness back to the breath, to be fully merged in the breath. And then we're just going to send that awareness up and over there, down into the center of the chest, our Anahata chakra. And from here, we'll just make a consecration of our time together today. So just offering up our time to the service of all beings. And maybe we're offering our entire day, just the next hour. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be at peace. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. And we'll take a deep breath and open the eyes. So I'm really excited about today because we're going to be talking about tapas. And it has to do with willingness, which I think, especially this time of the year, is important to just look at and think about, because you know, we often start the year with really good intentions that can be forgotten about. And so when we think about willingness, I think the more we think about it in those early stages, the more we can sort of stay with us through the year. But we're going to be talking about willingness versus willpower today. So tapas is our third niyama. And there are five, so we've got just a couple more to go after today. And tapas is also mentioned many, many times in the Gita. And there it tends to mean austerity, or sort of dedication and commitment. And I also see it as meaning like spiritual enthusiasm or sort of cultivation of willingness is another way of looking at it. And I just thought to start with, I'm going to read something that I wrote, I think a couple of years ago, I wrote about tapas. And I thought I'd read it. It talks about the phoenix and Chinese New Year. This year is the year of the fire rooster. And the neo-pagans I know are calling it the year of the phoenix. So I thought, oh, how apt. So I'm just going to read it, and it talks a bit about what tapas is. So legend has it that there was once a bird that lived for over 1,000 years, the phoenix. Every morning without fail at dawn, it would sing a beautiful song, so beautiful that the sun god would stop his chariot to listen. It was the only bird of its kind in the whole world, and in order to give birth to a new phoenix, it had to die. And when this time came, the phoenix would build itself a nest of aromatic wood, set it on fire, and allow itself to be consumed by the flames. From the pile of ashes, a new phoenix would rise. Recognizing the treasure of its former life, the young and powerful phoenix would embalm the ashes of its predecessor in an egg of myrrh and then fly to the city of the sun to deposit the egg on the altar of the sun god. Tapas, our third niyama, asks us to become the phoenix. So the Sanskrit word literally means heat, and is often translated as burning zeal, spiritual enthusiasm, catharsis, and self-discipline. It speaks to building a life of such passion for love and truth and your journey that we become willing to do whatever it takes to create metaphorical nests and set fire to our old selves. So I love this idea of burning ourselves clean, perhaps. And Deborah Adeli in the Yamas and Niyamas book that I often quote talks about like tapas having the sense of cooking ourselves in the fire of discipline to transform ourselves into something else. And she talks about how it changes us. Just like, you know, cooking an egg denatures the egg, it changes it into a different structure. It's like tapas, this sort of heat, metaphorical heat, eventually changes our own nature. So it's no joke, tapas is absolutely no joke. And of all the yamas and niyamas, tapas is actually can be one of the most painful for people because it asks us to take the disciplines of yoga and really commit to those as a regular practice. So that's, you know, all the yamas we've talked about and the niyamas and then the other practices of yoga. So to serve others, to be kind, to speak the truth, to purify our thoughts, to purify our bodies, to meditate, to practice. And really just do them every day or do them, you know, with enthusiasm. And you can imagine that doesn't always go well. People like a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but really having to commit to something can start to bring up a lot of resistance in people. So I'm just going to carry on reading what I wrote. In committing, we have to go head to head, or rather heart to head with our egos. And it can feel like a battle of epic proportions. And I think we've probably all had that, you know, this idea that, oh, we're going to get up every morning at 6 a.m. and meditate on February the 10th on a gray morning where we haven't had any sleep. We wake up and we're sort of screaming inside that we just absolutely do not want to do that. I mean, just no way do we want to do that. And it feels like such a battle taking place in our heads right then. Because like, I know I should do it. I should do it. And I want. But tapas is like our trusty steed. It's sort of when our egos tell us that we should stay in bed rather than get up and meditate, it's actually tapas that drags us out from under the duvet and onto the cushion. And it also, like, when we're more set on being right than being loving, it's tapas that actually keeps our lips shut. And it sounds forceful, but it's not, and we're going to talk about the difference later. So the question is, how do we overcome these years spent mindlessly following our urges? And the Gita talks about this, how we're just sort of mindlessly going around, just doing everything our senses engage us to do. And the answer is by cultivating enthusiasm. That's how we overcome it. And it's an enthusiasm that comes from this burning desire of the heart and not the mind. So it's hard to be enthusiastic about getting out of bed to practice meditation if it's simply because we think we should. And this is where it's sort of coming back to this idea of should is kind of the clue. If we think we have to, tapas is not interested in what the mind thinks, not one iota. And indeed, if we're committed to getting up to meditate because we think it's going to make us a better person or make us look good or we're reaching some goal where everyone we meet will go, oh, look, she's shiny and glowing and wow, I wish I could have what she has, then that enthusiasm is just reinforcing the ego. And likewise, you know, if you're committed to quitting sugar because you read an article that suggested you should, well, that kind of motivation is more like, you know, a New Year's resolution. It sort of lacks this heartfelt burning passion that will see it last more than a month. So instead, we must practice what Krishna calls in the Bhagavad Gita pure tapas. And that's a tapas of zeal and sincerity. And to do so, we have to become deeply intimate with the true desire in our hearts. I'm going to talk about that a bit later. So when the bed is more comfortable for us to stay in than the meditation cushion, say, then we just remind ourselves that our burning intention is to be free, or it's to know love, or whatever the words are, and we're going to talk about that a bit later. And that makes us get up. rather than sort of making us get up, we just get up. We just get up. And the next day, when it's a bit colder, we had a bad night's sleep, and remind ourselves again of this soul's yearning to serve the world, perhaps, and we get up. We get up. And like the phoenix, which sings every day at dawn, we just keep turning up. Not because we think we should, but because it is beautiful. And because we are committed to doing so, we cannot not do so. We do so for love, for growth. We just cannot not do it. Just like the phoenix who wakes up every morning at dawn and sings this beautiful song. So the beauty of pure tapas is that when we make a choice that aligns with the fire inside, we fan the flames so that the fire burns brighter. So that the next time the choice becomes even easier, so it'll create this path. And we don't have to wait thousands of years, like the phoenix, to commit ourselves to the flames. We can just emerge more brilliant with every choice we make to follow the path to truth. And then finally, I just sort of close with this paragraph. So with practice, we can see that there never really was this epic battle that we imagined between heart and head. And if you are at the moment working on... with A Course in Miracles and with Regina's class on gentle healing, I think it's called, where we're looking at, you know, resistance. What is it? Is it even something? Like, you're not upset for the reasons you think that we're making it up. We're seeing things that aren't there. With the practice of tapas, you come to sort of realize that you're in battle with something that didn't even exist. And there's really not been a sacrifice to do this. And like the new phoenix, which collects and embalms the ashes of the old to present to the sun god, we can learn to look at that which we give up with this kind of reverence and gratitude, a real gratitude for sort of the resistance that's emerged and then been let go of, or has come to our awareness that wasn't even there. And then I quote Sufi Llewellyn Vaughan Lee, who says, "It is thanks to being presented with things to let go of that we become in our entirety wood for the fire of love." And just and Deborah Adele talks about this as well in her book. Let me just find it here. She talks, she cites St. John of the Cross in The Dark Night of the Soul. He's talking about the harshness of catharsis. In his writings, he uses the example of a log being thrown into the fire to describe the process of being transformed by fire. He says that at first the log doesn't look anything like the fire, and if the log has some impurities on the outside, it will initially stink as it burns. But after a time, the log begins to look more and more like the fire, eventually becoming the fire itself. And it's kind of like that with tapas. We use this love and enthusiasm and spiritual aspiration, and we use that as the tapas that burns, burns us and drives us. And we pour everything into those flames until we emerge like as love, as the, whatever the spiritual aspiration was, whether it was freedom, we emerge as that. We're essentially using freedom to burn ourselves through to freedom. We're using love to burn ourselves through to love, or truth to burn ourselves through to truth. It's a really, really beautiful, beautiful niyama tapas. So I wanted to talk about the difference between willingness and willpower, because I think that's something that gets confusing. So there are plenty of willpower practices in yoga, and some are really helpful. And they deal a lot of them with like third chakra poses, working with what's called Manipura chakra. So there are a lot of the sort of hardcore poses you do, the warriors, some triangle is another. And it said that it clears this third chakra, which is about, you know, your willpower. And as I said, there's plenty to do that. When I was at my yoga school in Thailand or Mexico, one of those, I can't remember which month I was there, we were taught this practice to build our own willpower. And that was that if we got, we had to pick something we're excited about and not do it, basically. So if you're expecting something in the mail, and that you're really excited about, then the practice of willpower would be you don't open it. You don't open it for a whole day. You just try and forget about it. Or you could say, like, you say the mini fast. So if you're really into a show on TV or into something to eat, coffee or something like that, you just don't have it. Like these mini things you can do to help build your willpower. They sort of become bigger and sort of come into this idea of tapas as an austerity, so that you really do go on a full fast at some point if you're, you know, in a yoga practice, and it's helpful. The idea is that in yoga they say that what happens with tapas is that if you go against your thought to, or your, what you say is your commitment to, say you say you're going to turn up for meditation every morning at 6 a.m. in your living room, and you turn up on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, you don't turn up, it sends a signal to your subconscious that you can't be trusted, that you are not someone who honors your commitments. And so in future, the yogis say, when you say, oh, I'm going to do this, there's already something inside you that says, no, we've seen before how you do this and it doesn't count. It's like you're breaking the promises to yourself, and something subconsciously looks at that and says, I guess I'm not worthy of having promises made and kept, or, oh, this is just what we do. And it becomes sort of part of your patterning. So the yogis say, build that up by saying things like, I'm going to just meditate in bed for 5 minutes every day for a week, and then from there see how you feel in a week. Say, okay, now I'm going to meditate in bed for 10 minutes, and then maybe the next week is, okay, I'm just going to sit at the foot of my bed in the morning and get up and still like have my duvet around me. And then, but you stick to it, so you pick goals that you can stick to in order to increase your staying power, your willpower. I found it to be really helpful, mainly because it takes a lot of pressure off. I think sometimes it can be very daunting. When I think about committing to a physical yoga practice an hour a day, I know that I'm going to break that. I know that some days I'm just too busy. And so I just don't bother even committing at all. And by not committing at all, it's even worse, because then I just don't do anything. So I found that with myself, I have to sort of start off with these small steps. And just say, you know, today I'm going to do 5 minutes. I'm going to do 3 yoga poses. That's it. I'm going to do 3 yoga poses every day for the next 5 days. And then maybe look at my schedule and say that's not going to happen this week. So I'm just going to say, well, I'm going to just, you know, do a breathing break this week. But really stick to it. And it becomes much easier. And then you can sort of build on it. Because normally, you know, once you get on your mat or you get on your cushion or you start your sort of breath practice or observance of your thoughts, and you know, you go, I'm only here for 3 minutes, but normally you're being there for 10, sometimes 15, because you start having a good time. And there's this lovely quote. Again, it says, like, just don't wait, just get going. So often we feel like we're waiting to make this commitment. Oh, you know, I can't do that, I can't do this, because I can't commit to it, I can't commit to this. And it's like we're waiting for someone else to come along and inspire us, or we're waiting for some sort of burst of energy. Oh, okay. And one day I'll really will get up and do an hour of meditation every morning. We're kind of waiting on it. But as music critic Ernest Newman points out, Beethoven, Wagner, Bach, and Mozart sat down day after day to the job in hand with as much regularity as an accountant settles down each day to his figures. They didn't waste time waiting for inspiration. Rather, they became inspired because they sat down. And this is really what the willpower, the chakra 3, the idea of tapas that I've learned a little bit in yoga sort of talks about, this idea of just do it. Just do it in small steps. Do what you can. Commit to the small things you can, because you will get inspired once you get going and start doing it. And then you'll send a signal to yourself, sort of like a positive feedback loop, that would encourage you to do more and more and more. So that's really willpower. And I say it's it can be really helpful, but to me, this isn't what tapas is talking about. So I found a couple of really lovely articles that talk about willingness versus willpower, and I wanted to share them. Let's see. And I can't remember the name of this lovely lady who wrote this post. It was on Huffington Post. And she's talking about, you know, it's the beginning of the year and she's looking at her New Year's resolutions, and she decides this year not to use willpower but to use willingness. And she says, "We Americans love the idea of willpower. It's forceful, it's bold, it's intrepid, it reeks of individual determination, and it suggests just enough stalwart endurance to satisfy our stoic sensibilities. The will speaks in a commanding voice. It says, go forth, make it so. And there's some kickstart value in that," she says. "But I would argue that the real key to creating positive change over time is not so much will as it is willingness." And she says, "Unlike the will, which is all the rage, especially this time of year, willingness doesn't get a lot of airtime in our culture. It comes across as too passive, perhaps too cooperative, too eager to please, and dare we say it, a little too feminine." But she says, when it comes to shifting habits and behaviors, willingness is a much better and more reliable partner. And the problem is that will is a hard-driving taskmaster, and it tends to cement itself to an idea of success, and therefore as a reminder of the failure. Whereas the will tends to be open-minded and doesn't relish asking questions. So willingness tends to involve inquiry. That sort of leaves that space there. Where the will never says die, she says, willingness is continually reborn, and it gets smarter and stronger each time round. Because effectively, my shift here is asking, what am I willing to do differently in the service of these goals, rather than insisting I am going to do these things no matter what it takes. So what am I willing to do differently? And we'll come back to that later. I think that's an interesting point. So when I was Googling around, I also came across in Scientific American, and it talks about willingness versus willpower. And they did, one particular scientist, who's a psychologist, did a test to see which worked better. And he was looking at it from a very scientific viewpoint. But I think there are some things in there that really speak to maybe why we would want to approach our spiritual practice, our sadhana, whether it's, you know, getting up and reading something to contemplate, a Course in Miracles workbook exercise, something lovely written by a sage or master, or whether it's why would we want to go and sit outside in nature and just breathe in the morning, why would we think of the things we're grateful of before we go to sleep, why would we stop ourselves in the middle of an argument and just listen, why would we, when resistance comes up and we're feeling angry or upset or hurt, just allow some space for that and let it go, like why would we do those things? And, you know, sometimes I say we can think, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to make myself a better person. I'm going to apply my willpower and I'm going to do this. And then there is this approach from willingness. So the psychologist that's talked about in the Scientific American article is called Ibrahim Sine. And he wanted to explore the connections to intention and motivation from the standpoint of willfulness and willingness. So using willpower versus using willingness. So he did this by exploring self-talk. And that's just what it sounds like. It's that voice in your head that you know, articulates what you're thinking and spells out your options and intentions and hopes and fears. It's that ongoing conversation we have with ourselves. And he thought that the form and texture of self-talk, right down to the sentence structure, would be important in shaping plans and actions, and actually might be a tool for exerting will or being willing. So this is what he did. He had a group of volunteers work on a series of anagrams, a word from, say, source, like tomato sauce, to cause, or there would be even the word when, and they would have to come up with an anagram for it, which would be Hume. But before I started this task with this group, half of the volunteers were told to contemplate whether they would work on anagrams, while the others simply about the fact that they would be doing anagrams. So the difference is really subtle, but the former were basically putting their mind into a sense of wonder and questioning, an open-ended questioning, while the latter were asserting themselves and their willpower. So it was the difference, says the author, between the sort of, will I do this? You know, will I do this anagram in this case? Or I will do this. And the results were very surprising. So people who left this, who contemplated it first, actually completed significantly more of these anagrams than the people who were thinking to themselves, I will do this, I will complete anagrams. So in other words, those who kept their minds open were more successful in their goals and more motivated than those who declared the willpower to do it, their own will to do it. So obviously this particular psychologist and the article in Scientific American is looking at, what it does to the mind. But what this also says to me is that when you open your mind and have this sense of wonder and questioning that willingness allows, that something else comes through. So I would argue maybe that the reason all these people were able to do these significantly more anagrams than the people who use willpower is because they put themselves in a place where they were guided. They were guided to do the exercises. So I was thinking about this today. So I am going through A Course in Miracles workbook this year, and I have, attempted the workbook many, many times. And I normally get to about page 100 or less than 100 and something, and then start to give up. But normally it's around the time, a little bit before I start to weigh in, when that it's getting longer and longer, the things you have to do around the workbooks. But this year it feels very different, and I'm on day 6, so I can't say for sure it's going to last, but I hope it does. But the reason it feels different is because I'm, rather than read the lesson and think to myself, I'm going to do this really well, I'm going to be a really good student, I'm going to read through what it tells me to do, I'm going to practice it, I'm going to set my alarm for 4 times today right now, and I'm really going to think about it. And so one of the lessons is nothing I see has meaning. And I saw that what happened was my old habit of, I sit down with my willpower in my hand and my, and I would go, okay, nothing has meaning. And I would start to contemplate it and I go, okay, well, why does nothing have meaning? Is it because of this? Is it because of this? Is it because of this? And at some point I had the guidance to just stop with the analytic mind. That if I was going to contemplate these lessons every day, I just would want to do it very open-ended. So I could write questions like, does this mean nothing has meaning? But then I wouldn't explore it. I would just leave it as an open-ended question. And what I felt guided to do was just to allow the lessons, because they were channeled by someone and they're supposed to be, what you're supposed to do. But so, and allow that and just trust that that process is going to work and doesn't require a me putting myself on top of it. Doesn't require willpower from me or analysis or deep trying and understand what's going on. I'm just being guided to do it. So it's more of just a willingness. Let me see where I'm going. So what I found was that today is day 6. Today I haven't had any trouble for a start, and I followed Regina's advice actually. She mentioned you do one in the morning and then you sort of set your alarm for a time you think is going to be appropriate for you for the second one, and then once you've done the second one, you set your time for the next, and not worrying about it. I'm just not worrying about it, because if you're worrying about it, it's sort of defeating the purpose. And when you bring worry, you automatically don't want to do whatever it is, because you sort of yourself that it's something that builds anxiety. So I'm just turning up, and this morning I actually woke up and it shocked me, but I thought, I cannot wait to see what this lesson is. which has never happened. And I know it's only day six, but this really felt to me like something important. Like I had not cracked the nut, perhaps, but that there was something in this allowing what is to come through, being open-minded, and that this was sort of this willingness, just sort of asking myself, am I willing to, you know, sit down with this meditation, or am I willing to practice this today? Am I willing to, and you can apply it to anything, am I willing to listen to my partner as they scream and shout at me? Am I willing to see their side of the story? Am I willing to, you know, not block this person who's trying to cut in on the freeway? Am I willing? And just allowing that space allows something else to come through. And just to sort of finish up on a Scientific American article, he says the psychologist, he hypothesizes that because questions speak to possibility and freedom of choice, meditating on them might enhance feelings of motivation. So he's sort of being a scientist about why. Then he designs this other experiment to look at it a little bit differently. So he requires volunteers on the pretense that they're needed for handwriting study, and some write the words "I will" over and over and over again, and others "will I." And after priming the volunteers with these fake handwriting tasks, the psychologist then asked them to work on the anagrams again. And just as before, those who wrote "I will" didn't do very well, and those who wrote "will I" did tons and tons of anagrams successfully. And then he changed it from anagrams to exercise, and it was the same thing. That those who asked themselves "will I" ended up, you know, healthier and doing more exercise, and those that said "I will" didn't. And he discovered what's more, that when he asked them about it, they said that when they said "I will," those that were primed with this "I will" said that they were doing so because otherwise they would feel guilty or ashamed if they didn't. Whereas those who were primed with "will I" said, because I want to take more responsibility for my own health. This last finding, says the psychologist, is crucial because it indicates that those with questioning minds were more intrinsically motivated to change. They were looking for positive inspiration from within rather than attempting to hold themselves to a rigid standard. And what I read when he says this is that those who had willingness, the inspiration came from within them, whereas those who were practicing willpower were bringing in the I, or the me. That's how I interpret it. So while I mentioned earlier that willpower can be really helpful in certain things in your life, when it comes to your spiritual path, and this is what tapas is about, is it is willingness that we want to cultivate. Is this spiritual enthusiasm or zeal that we have. Excuse me, I'm just having a sip of my ginger lemon. Okay. So it's not that, you know, because we think we can create willpower, perhaps. You know, I'm just going to build my willpower. I'm going to have even more willpower than I've ever before. You know, we think those thoughts. It's just going to require more willpower. But we don't often think, oh, willingness, we can cultivate willingness, but we can. We absolutely can. And it really depends and starts with what the aspiration is. So I just wanted to read something from Adyashanti. He's back. Okay. So here's something called the Five Foundations, and it's in The Way of Liberation. It's available as a free PDF online, holybooks.com. But if you Google it, you'll find it. And he says the first thing you want to do is to clarify your aspiration, which means knowing exactly what it is that your spiritual life aspires to, not as a future goal, but in each moment. In other words, what do you value most in your life? Not in the sense of moral values, but in the sense of what is most important to you. Contemplate this question. Assume that you know what your highest aspiration is, even what is most important to you. Dig deep, contemplate, meditate on what the spiritual quest is about for you, and don't let anyone else define your aspiration for you. Look within until you find with complete clarity what you aspire to. And he goes on to say that the importance of this first foundation cannot be overemphasized, because life will unfold along the lines of what you value most. I really do think this holds very true. So we often say, you know where your willingness lies. We all know where our willingness lies because we can see in our lives where our willingness lies. I remember sitting down and thinking about my spiritual aspiration. And what was really helpful to me was one of Regina's old audios, The Secret, or something like Setting Intentions, the Secret Style. And she sort of talks about this, you know, really coming to some clarity about what your goals are, what your spiritual aspiration is. And I remember spending many hours doing this. It was really, really helpful to me. And I'll just read you what I came up with. And this is about 3 years ago. So it was, I know what perfect freedom and love I am. I am one in God, and with all I look upon and all I see is perfect love. I am joy, I am free, I am love, I am. And there was some more to it. It was an aspiration, it was intention, and it was a goal. And I sort of drilled into this contemplation of my spiritual aspiration. And she recommended that you write it in the present tense, so it feels like Adyashanti says, like it's happening now rather than this future goal. I'd read it every morning to myself, and that would help me a little bit through my day of some of the practices and the daily sadhana I wanted to do. But it sort of fell off. And I remember sort of wondering why. And the reason I think it fell off is because it changes. And also, as Adyashanti talks about, and I think there's an audio he talks about this too, is that there has to be a real authenticity. So it's very easy, 3 years ago when I was listening to Regina and she's saying things like, oh, I want to be perfect love and peace and joy. And you're like, oh, that sounds great, me too. But at the time, I think what happened was that wasn't really what I wanted. Maybe at the time, all I wanted was to just feel a bit of peace in my heart, or to not be so worked up. And really, maybe I know what perfect freedom and love I am was too bold a spiritual aspiration at the time. It was inauthentic to me at that time. And I remember, wanting this and cutting pictures out of magazines of women flying and birds and stuff like that. It kind of morphed, this aspiration. It sort of marinated over a few years. And what it seems to have landed on now is that rather than freedom, what I really want is to feel at home. To feel at home in my skin, and to feel at home in where I live. And when I say you're sort of feeling at home, it's less of the physical and more of the metaphorical, like feeling like I'm sort of complete and belong, that I'm in peace, that kind of at home, which is interesting to me because it's the very opposite, perhaps, of what I wrote years ago, which was, my aspiration was freedom. So one of the things I think is most important when we're thinking about willingness in this first stage is to really get in touch authentically with what your spiritual aspiration is. So if you sit down and think, I really want to get married. that doesn't sound like a spiritual issue, or I really want a partner with whom I can have a spiritual relationship with. Now, that might not sound in your mind, you might judge that and say, no, I'm supposed to use words like truth, and I want to know the truth, and I want to be oneness. I want to know I'm not separate. But that may not be true for you right now, maybe authentically, and we have to sort of trust that because, maybe our guidance is telling us that, committing yourself to having an authentic spiritual relationship is going to take you to the next stage of your spiritual journey. Who knows? But it's about trusting that. And then also I feel like very much like it's about revisiting the spiritual aspiration, the understanding that it morphs, it takes you from one place to the other. And so you're thinking it's just, oh, well, I this is what I said years ago and I'm sticking to it, because it might not be the case. I was thinking about spiritual aspiration, I suppose, and willingness and this intention and where I am right now. So it's sort of funny how willingness really gets you very far. It really does. So I remember last year was interesting for all of us, I'm sure. I was shocked by my own country's, one of my countries, my former country, my homeland, England's decision for Brexit. And I was also shocked at the election here in my country. And what that did for me was really rock my world in a very cathartic way. And it kind of shook me up to see, because you saw the suffering of people, you could see how devastated people were, or those who had voted certain ways, how much pain they'd been in and they'd been ignored, that I could see from that it was like someone turned up the pilot light inside me on my willingness for my spiritual path. It really was. It felt like it was very, very clear to me almost immediately in the latter end of November that the message was, now is the time. Now is the time you are going to do this. You are going to not talk the talk and not walk the walk. Like, enough. You've done that enough. You've written so many aspirations over your life, and you've written God knows how many intentions, and you've attempted to do A Course in Miracles, and you've, done yoga for 6 months and then stopped doing it for 3 months, and you've wanted, all these things that we sort of set ourselves as goals, which in the end aren't that important. They're just sort of bridges and practice for us to do. It's not that we have to do them. But I felt very deeply in myself that this was the time, that something had shifted and that the willpower wasn't needed anymore. It was just the willingness. And what fueled that willingness was just seeing the state of the world. It was like a catalyst, perhaps. And then, fortunately for me, at the same time, and this is where I sort of understand how far willingness can get you, is that my partner and I have talked about this before. We have been trying for a baby and we didn't have much success. And I had a couple of blood tests done, and it showed that I needed to make a few changes in my life physically, and I sort of gleaned energetically. And my whole life changed completely in November around that. There was just no question. There was no willpower involved in changing my entire diet and waking up in the morning, having to do certain things and cutting back on work and trying to be more peaceful. No willpower involved at all. I can't just say it wasn't a struggle at all. I mean, I'm just, because there is this willingness, a very, very deep willingness to do anything I can to have a child with my partner. So it's interesting, and I'm sure there are examples in your life as well of things that you have just so wanted for yourself that there was no willpower involved. You were just completely willing in every moment to do what it took, to do what it took. And I often think, goodness, if I could cultivate that same willingness for my spiritual path as I have for doing everything I need to do to help me on foot and have a baby, how beautiful would that be? But then I thought, well, I kind of am, because every time, and I hate to sort of feel like awful things are beneficial, but every time I open the news or look on Facebook and there's more upset, it's like, again, like I said, like the pilot lights turned up on my willingness to work on myself, because the only way I can serve others is to work on myself. And so it's this sort of deep awareness that now is the time to change, to dust out, I think as Regina says, sort of dust out the cobwebs of whatever's left. And I have a lot left. I'm sure I have a lot more left than her. But really, like, step it up. And if you know Teal Swan, I remember watching something with Teal Swan, and she was like, I've got 3 months, I'm giving myself 3 months and I've got to change everything around. And with that kind of willingness, I noticed like some very huge shifts mentally occurred. Like, a lot got let go. And I can honestly say I wasn't the one doing it. All I did was apply my willingness. That was all I came with, just some willingness. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want to share today. I know it's only 9:15. But yeah, so I think once we have this aspiration, as I say, once you sit down and think about that, then the willingness just kind of comes naturally. But the cultivation is perhaps, you know, thinking, returning to that spiritual aspirations, you know, once you, if you don't want to, and I'll keep coming back to meditation just because it's sort of an easy one, it's a bit lazy really to come back to, but if you don't want to get up in the morning and meditate, then instead you can just remember your aspiration. And maybe it's a word, or maybe it's, you know, you turn on the news and look how things are going to hell in a handbasket and realize now my willingness has kicked in because I'm willing to do this for the world. I'm willing to do this. I'm willing to work on myself and move out of, you know, these old habits of thinking that only add to suffering in the one mind. And whether it's, you know, sticky notes next to your bed or, say, setting your alarm, but all these things I think will come to you of how you can support your own willingness just naturally. I think once you lay that out, once you sow those seeds. And Jennifer Hadley, I don't know if you know her as a teacher, but I remember she talks a lot about willingness. I had no idea it was part of a 12 steps path was willingness. There's a lot of willingness talk in a lot of circles, but I remember she used to say, you know, even if you wake up in the morning and you just think, I don't want to do this today, then you just change that to like, I'm willing to think about maybe doing it today. And then it becomes a bit easier because there's sometimes you're like, I don't want to, you know, give in this argument at all. Like, I'm, you know, but then you sort of go, okay, well, maybe I'm willing to consider giving in this argument. And you go from there. And then once you start sort of with a tiny little bit of willingness, it's amazing. Just that one shift comes through and all of a sudden you can sit down and you can hear the other person's point of view or just remember that, you know, it doesn't really matter who's right or who's wrong. It's just, you know, it's just about being there and being present and being loving and turning up and doing the best you can. And some of the other things she talked about when I did her Masterful Living course, actually, was just prayers for willingness. So if you feel like your willingness is lacking, there, you know, write your own prayer. Your own dear God or whatever words you use. Here is my prayer for more willingness. Please give me more willingness so that I can practice more please be my willingness when I can't arrive with my own, that kind of thing. Let me see, there was a couple more things about willingness. I did a lot with willingness about 3 years ago. Let's have a look. In my journal. I used to write down every day, today I'm willing to be, I'm willing to be grateful, I'm willing to listen, I'm willing to do this, I'm willing to do that. That was my big one. Okay. Oh, yes. And one of the things I looked at was that my willingness, really, I had two choices. That was to extend love by letting go of thoughts, by being willing to let go of thoughts. And that would lead to peace, peace in my heart. Or if I directed that willingness to believe thoughts, so really passing judgment, and that would lead to sort of guilt and fear, you know, you take that step down and off you go. So in the moments, I just used to think, don't take my thoughts too seriously. When I have thoughts, just let them go. Just kind of don't take them so seriously. Don't get so attached to them. Just be willing to just sort of let them lie. And again, it's all this willingness. So I'm going to stop there. I don't know if anyone wants to add anything or say anything or share their willingness and type in what they're willing right now, and we'll wrap you in our prayers. Okay. So to end, there are a couple of physical practices which I really love, which are built for willingness, I believe. I certainly use them for willingness. And one is a mudra, and we're going to do while I play some music, perhaps. And the other it's really beautiful. It's like shape-shifting if you're into shamanism at all. And it's called sort of transitioning into a condor. So it's really about taking flight. It's about, you know, just letting yourself go, letting yourself be carried by someone else, like some power much deeper than you can know, and just sort of giving yourself over to that power by taking flight. So you sort of start off as if you are a condor on the edge of a cliff. And as you can imagine, you kind of like shake your shoulders and maybe flap your arms and bend the knees and stick the chest out and kind of just make all these really gentle movements as if you are this condor about to take flight and sort of have this idea in yourself of, you know, I'm willing to be lifted up and let go. And it's a really lovely practice. And there's something in it that sort of changes your, I don't know, your mindset. So you sort of become more open. So it's a really lovely one if you practice every day. If you're into movement, it's a very beautiful one. And then the other one we're going to do together right now is Vajra Pradama Mudra. So this is, Vajra means thunderbolt in Sanskrit, which is considered in yoga to be an expression of very powerfully focused energy. And in Buddhism, the thunderbolt represents the ultimate weapon against doubt. So really sort of willingness is sort of all wrapped up in this letting go of doubt, having complete faith, letting yourself be guided, giving up of the I of what I know best and just allowing, which often means letting go of doubts. And Vajrapadama Mudra symbolizes unshakable confidence. It's like unshakable strength, unshakable confidence in, and so it sort of really boosts your willingness. Like, I am willing and I allow. And practicing it sort of reminds you of your personal power, but really your faith in something much, much greater to move you. So if you wanted to do Vajra Pradama Mudra, what happens is we interlace the fingers in front of the chest. And then we place those interlaced fingers, our two hands, on the center of the chest, on the heart center. So it's a little lower than, well, it's sort of in line with the thymus, maybe a little bit lower. I'm really pushing it in there. And the thumbs, if you're wondering what to do with the thumbs are pointed upwards, so sort of pointing up into the shoulders. And then we just sort of hold that. And you can just have this as a meditation. You just sort of relax the shoulders and sit down and breathe. And just while you're holding the mudra. And the beautiful thing about mudras is it's just the power of the mudra brings in the energy. And because mudra has been practiced by thousands of people over thousands of years, we're tuning into all that energy too. So this is Vajra Pradama Mudra. And you can continue holding this if you like. But yeah, that's it for today. So that's tapas, this idea of, you know, letting ourselves be burned by love itself, so that we can be more love or more truth or more freedom or more hominess or more peace, whatever it is, that word that really resonates with us and is our spiritual aspiration. So next week, I can't remember what we're looking at, but we're looking at number 4 of the niyamas, and I'm sure it'll be lovely. So namaste from me this week, and so you're welcome to stay, obviously, holding Vajra Pradama Mudra, and I'm just going to play a song to end for today, and this is it's a song for Martin Luther King, who is, like, just one of my idols. He's such an inspiration. When I think of Martin Luther King, my willingness goes up, my pilot light gets a real big boost. And my dear friend David Jason Williams, DJ Undercover, sort of put one of his speeches to music and then did like a hip hop, really sweet song over it. So I wanted to play it today as it's Martin Luther King's Day. The man who told us that love is all we need, love is the only way. So namaste. I'll leave you with this and Vajra Pradama Mudra, and have a beautiful and blessed evening. Remind everyone to give earth.
Habitats and greens can't be weeded out, and all the beings on this planet this will be about. At first I didn't understand, I was freaking out, thought we would destroy this promised land that we dreamed about. But then I seen my doubts, and then I realized I had to redefine my mind deep beneath my scalp. It ain't an easy route, but if I wanted to live in perfect harmony, it's me who would need the scout. That's when I saw integrity, I had the least amount. Started to live compassionately, kick the demons out. At times I still got mad, so angry, I was screaming shout. But I slowed down to gain the patience to see it out. Now I don't need to pout. Started cooking for myself, stop eating out. Beans and legumes, what I'm sticking now. Juicing on my own, started eating sprouts. I stopped supporting the breeding of beef from cows. The truth is they're diseased before they reach your mouth. And all the feed and the feces that's leaking out into the rivers and the streams, got a sea in drought, keeping the bees die out. Now is the time that you guide my dreams, and now is the time that I wake up. Now is the time that I'm not sleeping. Now is the time to be enough, enough.